This week we have another parsha that's full of, you know, familiar stories, maybe. When we get back to Bereishis, sometimes it's like funny to go through the parsha because there's so many things that happen, and then you move on to the next week. So this week we are learning Parshas Vayera, and there are a lot of familiar events that we get to go through again. And I also would like to touch on the Haftorah this week as well. So we are going to start with source one that's on this page. It shows up when, after Yitzchak is born, so there is a little, there's another bit of tension between Sarah and Yitzchak, right? Like her, that side of the family, and Hagar and Yishmael. And Hagar and Yishmael are again pushed out of the house of Avraham. So we're told when she's traveling out of Avraham's house, when she's in the desert and she's run out of water, that she thinks everything is over. But then she receives a message. So the message is Vayishma Elokim Eskol Hanar. So Hashem hears the voice of the child. Vayikra Malach Elokim El Hagar Min Hashemayim, and the Malach of Hashem calls out from Shemayim, calls out from the heavens, Vayomer Lo, and says to her, Malach Hagar, right? What's going on, Hagar? Malach Hagar, Al Tir'i Ki Shema Elokim Es Kol Hanar Basher Husham. You know, don't worry because God has heard this, the child. So this is the message that she receives. She's told, you know, like, don't worry, things will be okay, and Yishmael will be all right. And that's the message that she gets. So we might remember that this is actually kind of parallel to a story we actually also read last week. So we actually have already had a similar event that happened last week when Hagar was first kicked out of the house. And she also ended up in the desert. So she leaves the house, right? Because this is part of the right. So she runs away. Thank you. So she runs away, and she's also in the, you know, kind of wandering in the wilderness. And we're told Vayim Tsa'a Malach Hashem al Ein Hamayim Bamidbar, and the Malach finds her in the desert, Al Ein Hamayim. So she's here. She's actually near water. So again, we can point out some differences, some similarities. Al Ha'ain Bederech Shur. So she's by the spring on the road to Shur. So the Malach, again, the difference here, just spelling out what I just like referred to, is that here she's near a spring of water, and the second time around they don't have anything. They don't have any water, and that's part of the her. Sense of desperation. But be that as it may, the Malach finds her. Vayomer Hagar Shivcha Sarai Emi Zebas. Right? Vayomer, and the Malach says, Vayomer, pause, Hagar Shivcha Sarai Emi Zebas. Right? So the Shivcha of Sarai, where are you coming from? Vana Selechin, where are you going? Vatomer Vinay Sarai Kvirti Anochi Vorachas. And as was just pointed out, right, so she responds, well, I'm actually running away from Sarah. Vayomer lo Malach Hashem, and the Malach says to her, Shuvi al Gvirtich viz ani tachas yadah. So the Malach says to her, go back to Sarai. Okay, so the difference that I want to point out is her experience with the Malach seems a little bit different, not just in the message that the first one says, go back to Avraham's house, go back to Sarai, right? That the message is, the second time she's not really told to return per se, she's just told, don't worry, right? You're going to be okay, and Yishmael is going to be okay. But also the experience of the actual Malach seems to be a little bit different. The Meshech Chachma points out that there seems to be a difference in I don't want to say like where the Malach is. It's a little bit of a funny way of saying it, but the Torah describes it in terms of almost like space, right? So it says, Vayikra malach Elokim ve'el hagar min hashamayim. The first time this malach calls out min hashamayim. And the second time, it does not say anything like that.
Second time is calling from
Shemayim. Oh, sorry, the second time. Yeah, I know. As I was saying it, I confused even myself because I was like, I said the first time, but that didn't sound right. But it's just because on the source sheet it's first. Okay, so forget. Remember chronologically, the first time the malach, it doesn't say anything for calling out Mina Shemayim. But the second time the malach apparently is calling from Shemayim in order to have this conversation. Which seems a little bit strange. Why is the malach, right? Why is the actual malach experience, like, what is it about interacting with the malach that's different the second time around than the first time? So the message is a little bit different. You know, where she is again, maybe like a little bit different. There's water versus not water, the message, right, which relates to the message. But like.
So it also seems like there's a higher level of malach. The first one has to ask her, you know, where are you going? What are you doing?
Oh, okay.
The second one knows everything.
Okay, so if Min HaShemayim is like a higher level, then maybe another source of evidence you're suggesting is that the first one involves like a little bit of a back and forth where the Malach asks a question, where are you going? And then that kind of opens the conversation. The second time around, the Malach skips the pleasantries and kind of cuts to the chase. But you're suggesting maybe that's like the malach knows more of what's going on, right? Like there may actually be a sign that the malach is a higher level malach. So potentially maybe the second one is a sign of it being a higher level of an interaction. So let's think about that, right? What do these different kind of interactions and the way it's described maybe mean for what Hagar is experiencing?
Well, and when the last part, when it says, and submit to her harsh treatment, I mean, that's also pointing out that the Malach knows that she is being treated cruelly.
So, yes.
They're still telling her to go back.
Right, okay, so, in this, sorry, I'll let you... finish.
No,
I
don't know where to go with it.
Okay.
Except that he's actually saying and submit to a harsh treatment. It's like going back to your slave owner and let him keep beating you.
Right. So in this case, we're not going to spend as much time going into the exact underpinnings of the interaction between Sarah or Sarai at the time, Sarah and Hagar, and it's kind of alluded to in the point that you're making at the end of source 2, that v'isani tachas yadeha, right, that in some way, again, the translation we have is submit to her harsh treatment, but one point is she can feel suffering even if, right, like v'isani, meaning go back, she may be uncomfortable with this situation, but that doesn't necessarily mean that, like, again, just in terms of the context, without going into like the whole story, like, it may not be like objectively painful, like the way you're describing in terms of what a slave owner might, right, so that somebody might be beating her, but it may still be like psychologically painful for her. So that just pointing out that like some of that that difference, that maybe like the in going into the story, we may want to kind of differentiate between some of those elements. But still, to what you're suggesting, we might point out kind of like a contrast to what we were saying before, where when the Malach asks a question and the Malach sounds like he doesn't really know what's going on, right? Where are you coming from? Where are you going? And she just says, I'm running away. So the fact that the Malach says to her, well, I know it's been very rough for you, right, that implies that maybe the Malach actually does know more of what's going on than his. I don't know, I can't even say his, whatever. Than the Malach's question implies.
She said me pnei Sarah.
Yeah. Okay. Yes. So is the fact that she's running away because of Sarai? So is that okay? So just pointing out that that.
In source too, but Rashi over there says that the Malach was just trying to get her in a conversation.
Right, so this...
And it could be that by source one already, she's talked to Malachim, so You don't need any more of that.
You don't need any of that opening. So we could have gone that direction, pointing out that when the Malach asks the question, this is not the only time that a Malach asks the question, and also not only the time, right, similar, potentially like parallel to the times that Hashem asks questions, and we find a similar note from Rashi and from Chazal, that sometimes a question is a way to start a conversation, not because I don't know the answer, but because I am opening up the opportunity to discuss what's going on. So keeping that in mind as well, when the Malach asks a question, maybe it's a sign of you know, limited knowledge on the part of the Malach, and sometimes not. So that's also potentially kind of up in the air. So these differences, focusing what I pointed out from the Meshech Chachma, Min HaShamayim, maybe ties into, you know, some of the sides that we're saying, that one time it's calling out Min HaShamayim, one time it's not. So what is the difference in Hagar's experience of the Malach between these two events? So that's the first thing that I want to lay out there. The second thing that I want to discuss is in Source 3. So that comes to the Haftorah. So this week, the Haftorah, it's not the shortest Haftorah that we read. I don't think it's the longest, but it's got there's a lot going on there. And it is the story of Elisha. So Elisha, the Navi, one of the Navim in Malachim Beis. So Elisha, this is the story of two of the Nisim, two of the miracles that Elisha oversaw, kind of did. I don't know, the miracles he did. But the first one is the story of a woman who comes to Elisha and says, my husband has died and I now have all of his debt and we don't know what to do, right? They're gonna take my children, is what she says. And he asks her, what do you have in the house? And she has oil, and he basically creates, you know, a never-ending jug of oil so that she can have enough oil to sell to have enough money to pay the debt. So that's the first story. And then the second story of Elisha is the Isha HaShunamis. There's a woman whose home Elisha passes by, who like is in the area that he travels through regularly. And what she does is she, as we're going to see, she creates a room for him. And a place to stay, and she hosts him. So Elisha, as a reward, right, and in order to repay this woman, notices he's actually told that it's pointed out to him that she doesn't have any children. So you know, he davens on her behalf, let's say, and she ends up having a child, and then that child dies. The woman goes to Elisha and says, like, well, why did you put me through that to begin with? Like, why give me the child if that was going to happen? And then Elisha brings the child back to life. So that's the overall, those are the two stories. This is one of the times that one of the Nevi'im performs some form of, like, Tchias HaMesim, something, bring somebody back to life. It was also Eliyahu. There's a different story about Eliyahu, but this is the story of Elisha. So we have both of these stories in this week's Parsha, in this week's Haftorah. I like pointing out, there's something to think about, is in the Sfardim, don't read the full second story. So if you note, this is a question. I have some thoughts, but like there's a question to ask, is the in Sfardim, they actually stop in the middle of the second story. The son actually comes back and says, my head, and he dies. And then the woman tells her husband, I need to go find the Navi right now. And he's like, why do you need to go find the Navi? And then, end of the Haftorah, and then it ends on a cliffhanger, which is kind of a funny place to end the story. It seems like the exciting part is about to come. So, question to just leave out there, we could discuss afterwards. Why would you end the Haftorah there? Like, well, why should that be the whole Haftorah that we read? But during the story that everybody reads. So this woman is trying to figure out what to do with Elisha, how she can help out. So that's in Source 3. So she says, Vatomer el Isha. So she says to her husband, just grammatically, if we're looking in the Hebrew, so Isha, right, the Mapik Hey, right, Ha'ish Shala. So that's something we may, right, those are the kinds of things when there's a little dot in the hay, and then you hear the, you might hear the Balkore with that short hey at the end of a word, and noticing that, like, that's the kind of thing that you're supposed to do because it actually changes the meaning of the word, right? Isha versus Isha with a mapik hey, one means woman and one means her husband. So they mean different things. So that's the kind of thing you might, as a Balkori, have to watch out for. So just a little note. So, Batomer Elisha, so she says to her husband, Hineina yadati ki ish Elokim kadoshu, right? We know that this is a holy man who over aleinu tamid, and he's always going by. He's always passing through our town. So if he's always here, nasa na alias kir kitana, why don't we build him a little guest room? Yeah, an office. Why don't we make a little room for him? Vinasim lo sham, and we'll put there for him. Vinasim lo sham mita v'shulchan v'chise yumenora. And we're going to put a bed and a table and a chair and a lamp. And when he stops by, when he's in town, so then he'll have a place to stay. So he'll have a little home away from home. He'll be able to stay. We'll make sure that we have a guest room ready for him. So that's her suggestion. That's what they do. And that, again, precipitates his wanting to pay her back and how they end up having this this longer relationship. So... one note about setting up this room is that when she's describing this room that they're setting up, so she doesn't just say, let's build a room for him. She actually describes more than that. She says, let's build this room. And also, she describes, like, furnishing the room, right? She, like, kind of, she goes all out on it. Seemingly in ways that, like, she doesn't really need to, right? It could have just been like, let's make him a room. I don't know. What do you have in a guest room? In a guest room, you have a bed, and, like, you're fine. But she doesn't say that. She says, let's make this little room. And as you said before, it's not even just a room. It's like an office, right? Because it's not just putting a bed in there. It's put a bed, and, okay, maybe he needs a light. Fine, maybe he's okay. But also the table, right? Like, why do you need a table and a chair? He's setting up a whole desk that he's going to be sitting there to work and to eat in there, right? Why set up like a whole house for Elisha? You're bringing him into your home, so give him a guest room, give him a place to sleep, and then you'll host him. You'll have him at the table. You'll have him at the meals. Like, why does she describe furnishing the room with all of the amenities that could possibly be there? Why, you know, why describe it like that? Why does she have to list all of these things? Right, it seems like if she had left them out, like, it would have still been a perfectly good hosting situation, right? Just create a room and, like, he'll be fine. He'll have a place to stay. So why does she add to it? So that's what I want to discuss. Why is it that when she sets up this room, the Navi specifically describes all of the details of what she adds into the room instead of just a room, just a place to stay? Why does she need more than that when she sets up this living arrangement, this hosting arrangement for Elisha? Okay, so those are the two main questions for this week, related to this week. We've got the question about Hagar and her relationship with the Malach. Why does the Malach kind of change places? One time it's just talking to her, and then suddenly it's Min HaShamayim. It seems something different. We suggested different pieces of evidence from the Psukim that may imply, you know, what was better or worse about one experience than the other. But that's the main idea. Why is the Malach kind of in a different place? And the second part is from the Haftorah. Why, when the woman is setting up this room, does she set up so many details in Elisha's room? There's so much talk about this this story of Malachim. There's a lot. This comes up around Rosh Hashanah time. This is just, we could talk about the Haftorah all day, but you could think about there are notes about Rosh Hashanah that come up. So kind of some of those underpinnings. The fact that Chazal say the Navi in the Eliyahu story and the Elisha story are actually, they grow up to be Nevi'im themselves, Chazal say. And you could think about how this kind of sets their trajectory. This one, it says that she is, she hugs him, right? And Chazal say that word, ve'chavik, is an allusion or ties in to that this boy grows up to be the Chavakuk that we know, who wrote one of the Sfarim of Navi. So there's a lot going on in this Haftorah. If you're paying attention, you're looking at some of the themes of the Haftorah over time. There's definitely a lot to delve into. So those are the two main questions. Okay, the third part, the third thing that I want to look at is a pasuk in Sefer Yecheskel. So in Sefer Yecheskel, it's describing the Beis HaMikdash. So Yecheskel is describing the coming Beis HaMikdash, what we say the third Beis HaMikdash. We're not going to get into all the details of in Yecheskel's time, the Beis HaMikdash is going to happen, but it's only the second Beis HaMikdash, and it kind of lines up with some of what Yecheskel says, but not entirely. And the second Beis HaMikdash is kind of a combination of things from the first and the second, and Yecheskel is describing the third Beis HaMikdash. So it says in Sefer Yecheskel, Ubevo Am Ha'aretz. So when people come to the Beis HaMikdash, Lifnei Hashem, Bemoadim, so people come before Hashem on the holidays, Haba Derech Shart Safon. So anyone who comes by way of the northern gate, lishtachavos, to bow, yitze derech shar negev. So that person, how do they exit? So they should leave through the south. So if you come in through the north, then you exit through the south. V'haba derech shar negev, but if you walk in through the south, yitze derech shar tzafona. So then you exit through the north. Lo yeshuv derech hashar asher ba'avo. You should not return by way of the gate that you entered. Ki nichecho yetze. Rather, ki nichecho yetze. You should go out, right, the one you're facing. Nichecho is what is opposite you, as it's translated here. But literally, right, like nochach would be facing. So it's, you should go out the one that you're facing. Just as a side note, as I'm reading the pasuk, we did have a discussion about the word ki. So if there was a shiur that we discussed the word ki and the different meanings of the word ki. So just noting here that it's lo yashuv derech hashar asher ba vo. You don't return by way of the gate that you entered. Ki nichecho yetzei. Rather, you should do something different. So that's like one of those times where ki means something, right, means ella, something a little different than because. Usually ki means because. It doesn't mean don't enter because you leave the other way. Right? This is kind of like an awkward transition. It really means something more like rather or but, you should do something different. So that's just, I'm just noticing that as we're reading, it kind of ties into something we discussed. So either way, there is this idea, this note that the Beis HaMikdash, you come in one side and you leave through the other side. Why would that be? Why should it be that there is this process? Right? Is Yecheskel just describing some traffic control? Like, makes it a lot easier. It'll get all confusing if people are coming in and they're going back, and like, stay in your line because there's so many people going to be going through. I mean, I guess we could think maybe there's a practical element, right? Like, there are going to be so many people going through the Beis HaMikdash if you're trying to jump lines. Like, it's going to slow everything down, right? Is that really what Yecheskel is trying to tell us, that that it's easier stay in your lane, right? Don't change lanes because it's safer that way? Is he just describing something practical? That it sounds like, is this a rule, right? It's almost like he's describing, like, this is what should happen, right? If you come in on this side, you should go the other way, right? I might have said that he doesn't even identify that there's like an entrance and an exit, right? You might have said like, oh, like what he should be doing is everyone should come in on this side and then like leave the other way, right? And that'll keep things flowing, right? That's not even what he's describing. So even if this is like a practical thing, like to keep things moving, that doesn't really even work here, because if you said everybody comes in here and leaves over there, so then yeah, there's like a flow to traffic. Everybody comes in, they stop in the Beis HaMikdash, they do what they need to do, they bow, they daven, they give a korban to the Kohen to take care of, and then they exit on the other side. But that's not even what's happening. Here, people are coming from both sides, right? Traffic is coming in from either side, from the north or the south. You could enter whichever one you want. He's not telling you which one to come in, but he is telling you, but when you leave the other way, right? So it doesn't, even if we wanted to make like a literal practical element to this, like it does, I don't even think it really solves the problem, right? It sounds like you really could come in wherever you want, but whenever you come in, make sure that you leave the other way. That seems to be the real rule. And that seems a little bit of a funny rule. I don't know, why is that? Why would it be that in the Beis HaMikdash, you specifically have to leave the opposite gate? Lo yashuv derech hashar asher ba vo. That you should specifically not leave through the gate that you entered. Why would that be a rule in the Beis HaMikdash?
It order that you get more of the flavor, you don't just see part of it. You'll see the whole thing by going all around.
Okay.
It'll make you more aware, understanding where you are.
Okay, so one nice idea, which we're not I'm not going to elaborate on as for the rest, but is a nice idea to think about, is that it may be a way of setting up a system where you actually have to engage with, or you have to experience the Beis HaMikdash, right? You actually have to pass through it in order to get to the other side, right? If you can't just come in and kind of like do your thing and then just sneak out again, right? Slip in and slip out. You actually have to be in to see it, and you're going to see the whole expanse of the Beis HaMikdash as you pass through. So that's a nice idea. I mean, we might have something maybe similar when we talk about the halacha of entering a shul, that the shul describes that the Gemara describes that you should walk in two doors worth into a shul. It's kind of like a funny measurement. But the idea is that you shouldn't just walk into the doorway of the shul for davening. You should actually walk further in. So why is that? So there's we could come up with a few different reasons, but maybe this is kind of like a similar expression of like you actually have to come in. Like if you're coming into shul, be there, right? Like be in the shul, be in it, be a part of the experience, actually see it. Don't like hide in the corner so that like you just slipped in and just slipped out. Sometimes it's like a time issue, right? We know that like there are reasons we have to like slip into shul and slip out. But I'm just saying like as like an idea, the halacha is trying to describe that you should move in, right? There's a halacha, you should as much as possible not, you're right, you could still go into two doors worth and then you're not that far in and you might still have to leave right after that. But the idea that you actually have to, when you're going to a holy space and you're going into this spiritual experience, like put yourself in there and actually be in it and not just, on the very outskirts of it.
Was there
right, exactly. So you engage with it, right? It's not just, don't just come and be a spectator on the very outside and, you know, you're sitting up in the bleachers, so you're like technically in the building, but you're off on the side, but actually come through. So that's a really important idea. It's a really nice idea, something to think about when it comes to the Beis HaMikdash and our lives, in our Mikdash Ma'at, our shul, and our other experiences around holiness is about really actually being in there and being present and being engaged. So that's one thought. Okay. Over the course of this year, we're going to propose a slightly different take on this halacha. So what I want to point out. So I'd like to point out an idea that is on the bottom of page one. It comes from, this study is called Exposure to Awe-Evoking Natural and Built Scenes. So they exposed people to pictures of nature and built scenes, so not natural scenes, so things that were like man-made. So they exposed people to these things in order to get people to a feeling of awe. So there were things that were grand and big and impressive and man-made objects that, you know, were huge and expansive, and also ones that were not. Right? They actually had things that were some big, some small, some impressive, some not, some natural, some not natural. So you ended up with like a bit of a mixture of those experiences. And they looked at the effects that it had. We've talked a little bit about some of the effects of awe, you know, including kind of like this and other studies looking at kind of like the restorative element of that it can kind of be refreshing, it can make people feel better. There are some studies that I thought about putting on the page, which also allude to some of the same ideas, which we'll mention, that that they looked at the effect of awe and pro-social behavior, which would be like giving or willingness to volunteer or helping others, that there is they found a relationship across a few different studies that inspiring awe, making people get the sense of something bigger than themselves, perhaps the smallness of their own self, and being able to then recognize like the space of other people and to be able to give to people. And what I want to take from some of these studies, so that's about awe in general, and you can explore that Also, which I think is important, we've discussed a little bit, just the benefits, the potential benefits of experiencing awe, and that might, and finding ways to do that. So what they, one of the things that I wanted to build, bring out of this is that in their discussion, what they note is that the findings indicate that when awe and beauty are equally matched, okay, everyday natural environments have a more positive effect than everyday built ones. So first, just a note, this is not our main point, but they noted that in their study, all things being equal, natural environments had a bigger effect on people than man-built pictures and environments. So that's just one note. Okay. But the fact that overall stronger effects were not observed in participants in the natural awe-evoking condition compared to those in the built awe-evoking condition might stem from the novelty of the scenes in our participants' awe-evoking conditions. So overall, though, even though, like, if you kind of, like, control for all the details, nature was, like, a little bit stronger than not nature, but overall, they both had essentially the same effect. And here they suggest the following. Familiarity dampens the positive effects of nature exposure by diminishing the sense of being away from everyday routines. So familiarity, it lowers the positive effects of nature. So there is an element to being out in nature, and there are benefits just being in normal nature, right? Going out into the park and just seeing things. But that also is not, it's tamped down a little bit when you're in a place which is familiar, in a place which is completely familiar, it lowers that a little bit by diminishing the sense of being away from everyday routines. So you kind of lose that sense of being somewhere new, of being somewhere different, of having a new experience. In light of the different positive effects we observed, okay, so they're just pointing out that the way it played out here is that mundane built scenes remind people of everyday responsibilities. So if you're looking at, like, a bridge, so a regular bridge in the city that isn't so, it's maybe it's kind of an impressive bridge because, like, we built a bridge, but on the other hand, like, you just think of your commute to work. Like, it doesn't, like, take you out of where you are. It doesn't take you out of your everyday experience. So that may actually, like, lose some of your, some of the effect of awe that you're trying to build, like, you know, this grand experience. But if you're building this grand experience in an environment where it's very familiar, it just feels like every day. It's just the same as any other day. The same route that I travel in the morning, or it's the same experience that I have, you know, all the time. So then it does weaken some of the effects.
But that would be different between a natural phenomenon and man-made phenomenon. The difference between a sunset or a sunrise and a bridge, that no matter how beautiful the bridge is and how awesome the bridge is or its architecture, it doesn't make any difference because
right. Every, so every and sunset, that and that is the
sunset,
next
every sunrise mm-hmm. is its own natural wonder.
Right. So the way they set it up here is, in contrast, natural mundane environments, like a natural environment, even though it's kind of an everyday normal thing, are leisure settings for most people and likely enhance feelings of being away. So even though, you know, there is still an element of a natural environment that is going to feel slightly removed from our everyday experience. It's going to be something that's not just routine. They posit that there's something about natural environments that are going to still maintain this element of being taken out of your space. But one of the things that they still have to account for, one of the things that they take into account here, and again, there are some other studies. The one I was mentioning, what was the other one I was saying? That have to take into account familiarity or they measure not just awe, but kind of the flip side is also measuring, keeping in mind, how often have you seen this or how much do you experience this in general? And there are the studies that are looking at the awe experience. They'll actually, again, try to control for that because they want to see I know some people are going to be more familiar and some people not. So they actually have to ask people about that. How familiar are you? Because you have to take that into account because you would expect And one of the things they can check is, does how awe-inspiring it is that affected by how familiar you are with the experience? And the answer is, yeah, it is. It's not just like a thing we talk about. It's not just like a feeling that we like describe, right? Like we know this idea like intuitively, but it's also a thing we can measure, and we also have to take into account when actually trying to create interventions for people, we have to take into account the fact that familiarity dampens the positive effects of exposure to these awe-inspiring events a little bit, right? It does affect it, and it does change our experience of these scenes. So there are benefits to awe, but we also have to recognize that there is a flip side of awe, which is familiarity. So there may be certain things that are awe-inspiring to us, but if we're there all the time, so then it's going to have a different effect. Not saying it doesn't have the same, it doesn't have an effect, right? It doesn't mean that it's going to be meaningless, but it for most people, will start to be different. It will start to be a different experience if it is something that you experience more often, if you become more familiar with, if it's something you're around more all the time. Potentially not even all the time, even just more time, right? The more time you spend there, the more used to it you might get. You might have had this experience on a vacation where you, depending on if you're, you know, it might be hiking, right? That might be your kind of trip, where you're out in, again, the expansive forest or something huge. But if you're on a long trip over the days, you know, you don't necessarily notice it in the same way, right? You become just a part of it. It becomes a part of the background, right? It might be a vacation to Hawaii and just looking out at the ocean. And then on day three, you wake up and you look out at the ocean and it still feels good, but it's part of the background. Now you wake up to the sound of the water hitting the shore, right? So it's still going to have an effect, but it's not going to be the same effect as you become more familiar with it.
You can say the same thing, though, about religion. Right? You have the Schlosser going, and you go every year by the 50th year that you're going.
Okay, so one of the things to think about and to deal with is that there are things that we do repeatedly and we do over time. And when it comes to our religious lives, there are things that happen repeatedly and that happen, you know, more than once and happen multiple times a year. So one way of recognizing this comes from the Sichos Musar. So the Sichos Musar is Rav Chaim Shmuel Levitz. And he, in here, he's going to be quoting the Yavetz, he's going to be quoting Rav Yaakov Emdin about our Pasuk in Yecheskel. So he suggests the following. Uveper shachased Yavetz the Pirkei Avos. So the Yavetz says on in Pirkei Avos, Kasov Lavares Tam HaKasuv, he writes about the reason, the explanation of the following Pasuk. Haba Derech Shar Tzafon Lishtachvos Yitzei Derech Shar Negev. Right, whoever comes in the north has to leave in the south. Right, this pasuk that we saw from Yecheskel, this idea that you come in one entrance and you leave through the other. What's the point of that? So skipping to the fourth line, we'll start with the fourth line. So now he's quoting the Yavetz. He says, "Hikpira Kadosh Baruch Hu shelo yire hashar beis pa'amim pen yishve be'inav hashar l'shar beiso." Why do you not want to see the same gate so many times? Because you don't want it to start feeling like it's your house. You don't want it to become so normal to you, so familiar that it's as if this is my place, right? You don't want to become so accustomed to it, so habituated to this Makom HaMikdash, this place of the Beis HaMikdash, that don't stay in this one place, don't walk in and out of this one door. The Kiros HaBais, the Kiros HaV, you don't want the walls to feel like your walls. V'zahaya inin Chet HaEgel, that was part, he suggested, as part of the Chet HaEgel, Shaya Ol B'socham, that the tent, the Ohel Moed is in the middle, Ad Shema Asubo, until it just becomes nothing to them. Ve'amru Asaylanu Elokim, Umoshe, Asaylanu Elokim, I don't know, Umoshe Rabbeinu Hirgish Bezeh, Moshe sensed that, V'nate HaOhel Michutz Machane, Herchek Min, Harachu Min HaMachane. So in the end, Moshe actually moves his camp out, right? Moshe, who is like the center, his tent, sorry, if I said camp. He moves his tent out from the middle of the camp, right? He's in the center, and everyone gets so used to him being a part of it, and his, you know, he represents like the center of of the religious experience. And when it's right there and you're passing by it every day, so then it becomes just a part of your environment. And Moshe removes himself from that. So the Torah, the Navi, is setting up a situation where we have to create systems. We have to put systems in place to keep the awe-inspiring awe-inspiring. So to the extent possible, we know you're going to go through the Beis HaMikdash, but you shouldn't treat the Beis HaMikdash the same way you would treat your own home, right? It's different. This connection between maintaining a sense of awe in the Beis HaMikdash, we might suggest, right, relates to the pasuk of Es Mikdashi Tiro, right? That there's a specific element of Yira that applies to the Beis HaMikdash. The Beis HaMikdash, as much as we are connected to it, and we find importance in it, and we find meaning in it, it's not the same as saying that it's yours. It's not the same as saying it's your home. It's not the same as saying treat it like you would any other place. So in order to maintain this this feeling of Yira, in order to maintain a sense of awe, the Navi tells us, don't walk around like you do at home, right? Don't spend too much time in this one place, getting so accustomed to it and so used to it and so familiar with it that it's going to lose that element. It's going to lose that sense. Because, again, the more we can find, we can experience something which is awe-inducing, but familiarity is going to dampen that experience. It's going to lose it a little bit. So we come up with a process, a system, to some extent, to kind of remove ourselves from that experience. The Navi, Elisha, right? Different Navi. So we were talking about Yechezkel in the Beis HaMikdash. Elisha is going to be passing through town and spending time in this house. So the woman says, you know what? We want to make sure that he's comfortable here. We want to make sure that he has a place to stay. It's not right that this holy man should pass through town every time and he has to find a hotel. He doesn't know where he's going to stay. He should have a set place to live. But she said, well, that's not enough. It's not enough to just find a bed for him. We need to make sure that we don't fall into the trap, that we invite him in, he's going to become a part of our lives, he's going to eat at our tables, he's going to hang out with us during lunch, and that we're going to treat him the same way we would treat anybody else. Right? This Navi, this person who is supposed to be inspiring the Jewish people, who we're supposed to see in there as a role model, right? If we bring him in too much, if we spend too much time with him in a regular environment, so then maybe we're going to lose some of that. Maybe we're going to lose a sense of that awe that he's supposed to be inspiring. Rav Yonasan Eibshitz suggests the following about the Isha Shunamis, that the Gemara says in Brachos, Haros Elihanos Yehane Ke Elisha. Whoever wants to, holds up Elisha as an ideal, that you should, you know, treat people like Elisha. What does that mean? Venir Levair, based on the Pasuk in Eicha, B'nei Tzion HaYekarim HaMemulaim, Bapaz, Icha Nechshavu, Lenivle Cheres. So the Bnei Tzion, who are so precious, like gold, now they are considered like Cheres, like earth, like pottery, like garbage. Perish al pi my deisa bishas, like it says. So what does that pasuk in Eicha mean? That they started out as that they started out like gold and then they became Cheres. So the Gemara in Sanhedrin says, Lama dome Talmud Chacham b'fnei am ha'aretz. What is a Talmud Chacham? What is he considered to be in front of, the hoi ploy? So b'tchila dome l'kidon shel zahav. At first, he starts out like a special gold container, pitcher. Siper imo dome l'shal kesef, and they start to talk to him, and then he becomes kesef. Achal imo, they start to eat with him, dome l'kli cheres, and then he just becomes cheres. So the Gemara in Sanhedrin says, you start out with a Talmud Chacham, you start out with somebody that people respect, and then the more you talk to him, you spend all of you spend more meals with him, and then you start grow so accustomed to being around him that you don't necessarily treat him the way that that you should. You don't necessarily think of them in the same way that the respect that you should give such a person. Ve'ulam nikiye hadas Rabbi Yerushalayim lo hayu mesubin al hashulchan imi shelo meisav yimahin bedin. But in Yerushalayim, things were different. In Yerushalayim, they treated people, But in Yerushalayim, they knew how to treat the Talmidei Chachamim. They still treated them like gold. And he says, this is what Yirmiyahu was talking about in Eicha, that the Talmidei Chachamim, they started out as gold. They started out as important people that we knew to respect, that we understood had a special place and a special role in the community. And then we just treated them like anybody else. We just decided they're whatever. We're all people, so why should I think about them any differently than me? Why should you know what do they have that I don't have? Vizehu shekonin Yirmiyahu. That's what Yirmiyahu was talking about in Yecheskel. Vizehu haya inyan Elisha shaya lo mita miyuchad. That's why he has his own bed. V'lo haya meisav imahin al hashulchan. And he also doesn't eat with them. He doesn't. Right? She gives him his own table. Let him. Okay, is it saying that like they never ate a meal with Elisha? No, I don't think you have. I don't think that's like implied either. Doesn't mean like they never ate a meal with him. But the point is, he doesn't become one of the household members. He's not just another person in the house. He's not. He has his own space. He has his own room. He has his own table. Sometimes does he eat with us? Sure. You can. It doesn't mean don't talk to Talmidei Chachamim. Doesn't mean right. Siperi Mahim. You talk to them, and then all of a sudden, all is lost because you had a conversation with them. But recognizing that there are still things that you can set up in our own space in our own ways, in our own processes to try to maintain an element of the awe and the yira and the separateness and the difference that comes from something great and someone great and the inspiring nature that they bring with them.
So the point in that in those psukim are that he is to be kept separate.
We discussed a few different things. We're talking about Elisha? Elisha?
Yeah, okay. In the Haftorah.
Okay.
That the reason that it's so picayune and that we're...
Yeah, we're going to set him up with all these details. Right, exactly.
is that the point is to keep him separate and to make sure that he has his own space.
Right.
And he is not one of us.
Exactly. Yes, so that's what he's suggesting.
And that's,
yeah, so,
that's
so,
the point of pointing out the individual pieces.
Exactly.
Keep him as a separate person.
Exactly. So that's what Rav Yonah Naipshitz is suggesting. Exactly. Is that she doesn't just say let's add on a room to our house and he'll live with us when he's here. She says we'll give him a bed and a shulchan and a kisa. Right. He's going to have his own space and he can still be separate. Again, I also want to stress like this doesn't mean like. Never eat lunch with a rabbi, right? Like, that's not the point, right? It's not like they have to live on their own planet. That's not the idea. But she can still set up a system that maintains his separateness and his not just being wrapped up into the rest of the family that will allow the Yira to live and the inspiring words that he brings with him to permeate through her family as well, right? That she's not setting up a situation where now it's just Uncle Elisha who's going to stop by, but that he's still a role model as a Navi and as a Talmud Chacham and as an important person, that he can still influence them and he can still be a part of it, but that he can still have this, they can also still maintain, right? They're, I also want to point out, it's not, they are setting up for themselves something to maintain the positive effect on themselves, right? So she is finding a way and saying, I want to do this good thing, but I recognize that this good thing also has some could have unintended consequences, right? That if we bring him in, it's good to be around him. But on the other hand, we have to take into account the consequences of bringing him in. And therefore, for herself and her family and for what's appropriate for them, she's able to set up a different type of environment that also can keep some of these positive benefits without too many of the negative ones, right? And she's setting it up for herself to do that. And as we come to this week's Parsha, I think that we should think about Hagar's experience with Malachim, right? We've seen it in two Parshios. And first I want to look at something from last week's Parsha. When Hagar first sees the Malach, Rashi points out that there's a conversation that she has with the Malach. We pointed out some things that the Malach does that's similar to other Malachim. you know, he asks questions, like, right, like Malachim and Hashem, like they ask questions, they open up the conversation. There are things that are similar. But Rashi points out something that's actually different about her conversation that we don't find by some other ones, right? When we have Ishis Manoach and Manoach, they meet a Malach, right? They've they're just regular people and they meet a Malach. What's the result of their conversation? The Malach leaves and then they're like, oh my goodness, I can't believe that just happened. That was crazy. Are we going to be okay? We just met a Malach. You don't find Hagar doing anything like that. Right? Hagar's reaction doesn't seem to be like shock or like surprise that she's talking to a Malach, right? Like we might have expected, right? By the Nevi'im, all right, they talk to Malach, and maybe we're not surprised, right? But right, the first time Shmuel gets a Nevuah, he doesn't really understand what it is, and he's confused. And it has to be explained to him that he's having a nevuah, right? When Manoach and his wife have an experience with a malach, they're like shocked. Hagar doesn't seem to have the same experience. So Rashi says that Hagam Halom, she says, have I also seen a malach? Right, when she's naming this spring, she says, whoa, have I seen a malach? And Rashi says that she's surprised. Even here in the deserts, Ra'isi Shlucho Shal Makom. Even here I saw a Malach. That seems to be her surprise, right? But he points out, her surprise is not, I can't believe I saw a Malach. It's like, wow, I can't believe I saw one here, right? That's a different implication. Why is that? So Rashi spells out from Chazal that Va'teida Shahaisa Regila Lir Osam. She must have been used to seeing them. Shari Manoach Ra'as HaMalach, right? Because Manoach sees a Malach for the first time, and he's like, whoa, this is going to be crazy. But she must be used to this by now. This is just a normal thing, right? She lives in Avraham's house, and this is just part of life. So when Hagar has this experience, it doesn't strike her. It doesn't strike her as weird. She falls into this trap of this. It's a Malach, but it's familiar to her, right? This is... she's not the Navi. She's not the Nevi'ah.
It's only part of her life. Thus far, it has not been part of his life. And
for
seeing.
Right, exactly. So there are some people are shocked by it. Why? Because like it was weird. It was a new thing. It was a novel experience. There's something different. But for her, she let the constant contact with Malachim kind of shave down the sharpness of the experience, right? It became familiar. It wasn't a novel experience. It was a familiar one. So when she sees a malach, she's not like, whoa, I can't believe there's a malach. She's, it's just another malach. Wow, they even make it out here into the desert. So weird, right? But her experience is different. The Meshech Chachma points out, by the second parsha, I'm not going to say something exactly like the Meshech Chachma, but he's pointing out that there's a change. There's a change between the first time she's out of the house and the second time. Because as we pointed out, she ran away the first time, and she's being sent back, right? She never really leaves Avraham's house. The Meshech Chachma says that the second time, V'hinei b'parshas lech lecha, kasuv ayomer malach Hashem. It just says the malach spoke to her, not min hashamayim. Ki ha'isa medaberes imo, it was just speaking to another person because she was used to that. Because there is normal for them to be around Avram's house. And she's supposed to be going back there. But now there's an element of distance. Now there's a separateness because now she's actually leaving Avram's house. So now she's actually not going to be in Avram's house anymore. Potentially now, the experience of a malach is different. Now it's mina shamayim. Now it's separate. It's not something that's going to be regila. It's not something that's going to be regular to her. So just to jump off of the idea of the Meshech Chachma pointing out this difference, I think maybe we can suggest that it's part of this, a similar idea. If we could elaborate on the fact that Hagar, originally, the beginning, it's just a normal thing for her. But she is now in an environment, she has put herself back in a place where it's actually not a normal thing, right? Maybe there's a place for us to think about even things which were normal, things which we got used to, there is still a place for stepping back and actually removing ourselves from those so that we can create a sense of distance again, and that now the Malach is speaking to her min hashamayim. Now the Malach is speaking to her from a little bit further away, and her experience is actually potentially different than it was originally. So this idea, the fact that the Malach is actually further away, is because now she's actually left Avram's house. Now she's actually not going to be in a place where it is a familiar everyday experience, and that can kind of in some of the words that we saw before, right? That some of the familiar makes us just think, it reminds people of our everyday daily responsibilities and the regular things that happen in our routine of our daily lives. But once we step out of that and we remove ourselves from that, we create a space where we're not going to experience this every day. We find the opportunity to find awe again in those places. So we saw this idea in the Beis HaMikdash that the Yavetz suggested. The Beis HaMikdash is a place where we don't want to grow too familiar with it. We don't want to grow too accustomed to any one space, because we want to maintain the sense of awe when we are in the Beis HaMikdash. That the Isha Shunamis sets up for herself and her family by housing Elisha, but creating a place, a system, to maintain some element of separateness, of awe, that they can still live in the house and still grow from and still benefit from the positive elements of. And that if we're taking it back to Hagar, that Hagar, even though originally we know that it's a regular conversation, but now that she's removed from it, now that she's able to step back, the Malach is speaking Min HaShamayim, that she's able to reignite this element of separateness, of awe, that they may not have had originally, or that she may not have had while in Avram's house, but was able to create this separate environment. And to think about, this is the kind of place we've talked about. We quoted some people before that. This is not and you should do this thing, right? This is not a point to end with you should not talk to rabbis. I don't know. Like, the point is not to come up with like a specific element, but I think the idea that that we see from the Navi in the Haftorah, and we see from different places, is that we have to look at our own lives and figure out what are the things that we want to maintain a sense of awe about, and we ourselves can also create that for ourselves. We may need to create some fences for ourselves, some separateness, some space. What are the things that are going to be important to me to maintain that about, and to think about how we can apply that element of even something that maybe has become familiar to us, like Hagar. We can step back and we can create that space, that separateness. And like the Isha Shunamis, that we choose it for ourselves in order to best benefit from the environment around us. What are the things that we can do in order to maintain the awe in our lives?